It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
There is a battle among Democrats to unseat incumbent Republican Andy Harris and Maryland's 1st Congressional District. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. One of those is Mike Pullen. He served as the Talbot County Attorney for some 24 years. Pullen is also co-founder of Talbot Rising that works on social, racial, economic, and environmental justice issues on the Eastern Shore. A shorter view of his views are clearly on the progressive side of the ledger, having been endorsed by the Lower Shore Progressive Caucus. But the Congressional 1st District is a conservative one, with Republicans holding sway on the Eastern Shore. Indeed, it was gerrymandered during former Governor Martin O'Malley's tenure to be even more so, reducing the number of Republican congressional members from 2 to 1 in Maryland. And he is in our studio this morning and to talk about some of the issues. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Don. Glad to be here.
And before we get started, we should take note, of course, of the passing of Kevin Kamenetz. He was running for governor of Maryland in the June Democratic primary. Baltimore County executive woke up early Thursday morning with chest pains and died later that day. Of course, it came as a shock to his colleagues. And, of course, we keep his family in our thoughts. And, Mike, what are your thoughts this morning as we get this news this week?
Well, it is a terrible shock. Kevin was a terrific public servant, serving about 25 years. He was he was just dedicated to the public good. We all feel so terrible for his family and his two sons and all his friends, and it's just a terrible shock. So my condolences, my heartfelt sympathies, and just very, very, very sad.
Brings it also very real. You know, the atmosphere, yeah. Want to turn to, first of all, if you become a congressional member, there's a good chance you may very well face the issue of impeachment. We've had a lot of Trump scandals going on, the allegations of Russian collusion, possible obstruction of justice has been suggested amongst many others. If you were sitting in the House of Representatives, which you could be next year, would you vote to impeach?
Well, Don, that's an excellent question. And what I would like to do is just reserve judgment on that. And depending on the outcome of the Mueller investigation, I think there's multifaceted leads that he's still tracking down. The question of collusion is wide open. Whether there was any impeachable offenses remains to be seen and proven. But having been a trial lawyer for 40 years and represented the local governments, I recognize the need to be deliberate and to be thoughtful and to base decisions on the facts. And I think we're going to see what the facts are. I think those facts are going to come out. I think Mueller's team is extremely well qualified and doing a very thorough job. The allegations, or not the allegations, but the revelations that we see in the public press seem to be pretty far reaching and seem to be, to me, to merit real serious consideration, serious discussion, and further investigation. Once all that comes to the fore, and I'm confident it will, we'll be in a good position to make decisions about what to do, if anything, about them. Impeachment is really a political question as much as a legal one, and I think the Democrats are going to be very thoughtful, be very deliberate, and be very measured, because it's a serious issue. And it's a serious step, and it requires serious deliberation, serious thought.
Would you say that I know that Congresswoman Maxine Waters out of California, a Democrat, has called for his impeachment, has been pushing that? Think it's just jumped too soon yet?
Well, I think it is a little premature. I think just on the political side of the ledger, there's no question that that's not going to happen at this point. And I think that that question does need to be deferred.
I want to turn to the fact that you're progressive, and we'll be getting into some of the issues. As I mentioned in the introduction, this is a conservative district and was designed actually as so by the former governor, Martin O'Malley. How do you match what your views are to the very conservative area that we live in, particularly here on the Eastern Shore?
Don, that's a great question. Thanks. I consider myself an FDR Democrat. Franklin Delano Roosevelt. My view is that the folks that live on the Eastern Shore, the folks that are struggling to get by, the folks that are going to work every day and paying their bills and just worried about their children, worried about their future, worried about their kids' education, their health care, worried about the environment. Those are the folks whose values I share. Those are the folks that I want to represent. Those are the folks who really need the understanding that government works. Government works, and it's their government. And I want to be their representative. I want to work for them. In other words, I don't perceive this as a split between progressives and conservatives. I view this, our values as very similar. My values are family values. I want to help young kids. I want to help children. I want to help families make it. I want to help people that work for a living. I want to help watermen, farmers. I want to help I believe in the values that have made this country what it is.
Let me ask you this, then, because a lot of people I've talked to on the conservative side, regular folks, they see government as the problem.
Correct.
Not the solution.
That's
I
correct.
Mean, so given what obviously some of the programs that you support, how do you convince them that it's not?
Well, so that's a very broad statement, and it's been accepted as the current narrative, and I get that. And I think the narrative needs to be examined because I don't think the narrative is correct. For example, let's take health care. Universal health care. We are in this together. If every single American was in the same pool and had the same access to the same health care system, it would reduce our costs, it would increase our coverage, it would increase the level of health for all Americans, it would make the question of providing health care for your kids irrelevant because it would be provided, and it would be provided for less money. The notion that that universal health care costs more and therefore can't be accomplished is incorrect. Every other country in the world, we're number 11. The first 10 all provide universal health care. They all provide universal health care for less. And there's a misconception about universal health care. It's not socialized medicine. It is absolutely not. We already have it. Medicare, the VA. Now, there's a difference between Medicare and the VA system. Medicare is simply single payer. We have private physicians, private health care providers providing the service, but they get paid through Medicare. And the reason that Medicare works and the reason that it works better is because it only costs 3% of the total amount of benefits to provide that service. Private insurance, on the other hand, is anywhere from 15 to 20% just for the administrative cost. Then you have the profit on top of that. When you add in the cost of prescription drugs on top of that, that is exclusively an American issue, we pay 42 or 43 cents of every single dollar to those three items: administrative costs for insurance companies, private profit for insurance companies, and the cost of pharmaceutical drugs.
Well, let me ask you this. How do you get from here to there? I mean, you have a whole industry. Insurance, right? I mean, one of the things that the former President Obama said, I think it was before when he was running, he said, you know, if we had to do it all over again, I might want a single payer, but we are where we are.
Right. That's another great question. And I don't have the answer to that question. I think but the answer will be developed as you go through the process of actually examining the kind of a program, universal care, that you want to deliver. The way to get there will become apparent as you delve into the details and understand the problem in its granular form. And so that's a good question, but I don't have the answer right now.
Let me turn to the environment, because I know you're a big supporter of offshore wind off Ocean City. However, Ocean City officials are not so crazy about it because the project will be too close as far as they're concerned in terms of being able to actually see these. On the other hand, the wind folks say if you push it out too far, they won't be able to actually set up the wind farm. Where are you on this, and what do you tell the folks in Ocean City?
Well, as with every land use decision, there are balances, benefits, and there are things that you've got to consider. As the county attorney for Talbot County, we went through two comprehensive plans, so I understand the concerns of individual groups and factions and various parts of a society. My sense is that this is a trade-off, and the concern, in my view, this is my personal view, the concerns of the Ocean City officials are a little bit overstated. I don't think that this is going to be a real detriment to the tourist industry. I do think that there will be a certain number of folks who want to come to Ocean City to see this, and there was a study done by the Sage Policy Group to support that. Nevertheless, I think people come to Ocean City because it's a wonderful place. It's a great place to vacation. It offers practically everything that you could want for a family, and therefore none of that is going to change. I liken it to utility poles on the highway. I'm certain that when the countryside was received electricity, that people began to notice these poles. And for several years, probably looked at them and recognized them. But after that, we don't even see them anymore. And the same thing is true with windmills. We were in Germany. My wife and I went for our 40th wedding anniversary. And the Germany has a great percentage of its power done through clean energy. These windmills, 600 feet high, were scattered throughout the countryside with these quaint, compact, historic German villages, and then this verdant green countryside, the hills and the mountains. It was beautiful, and you would see the windmills. And it didn't detract from the beauty of that scene. And my sense is that this is a trade-off that we have to make, because fossil fuels, there is no future, period. Climate change is real. Sea level rise is real. We on the Eastern Shore are the third most affected area in the entire United States from the effect of sea level rise. We need to do something about it. Clean energy. This project, for example, creates enough clean energy for 500,000 homes. That's huge. 9,700 jobs. Over $100 million of investment in infrastructure. So the benefits are huge.
Let me turn to agriculture and the environment. I think I've asked you before, but how do you balance those two? And in terms of the Chesapeake Bay, for example, we have the incumbent Republican who voted and strongly supported keeping the Restoration Bay money in the budget, despite what the Trump administration wanted to do, which was to take it out. How are you going to be all that different?
Well, I don't necessarily accept the idea that he was strongly in favor, because although the administration wanted to zero it out, and this program works and works well, and it's something that we must continue and expand, he voted to reduce it by $13 million, which was about the total was $73 million, and he wanted to take 13 of that. I don't know what that percentage is, but it's a significant portion. So I don't think that he's a zealous advocate for the Bay. My view is that we not only need to keep that funding in place, we need to increase our efforts. Now, agriculture versus environment, my sense is that farmers are stewards of the environment, cover crops. They are in the forefront on the Eastern Shore. And the reason is that their farms depend on the sustainability of this environment. And they are working hand in hand for sustainable agriculture and sustainable environment. My hope and my sense is that the folks that are concerned about the Bay and the farmers have common interests that we can identify and pursue. And we've already seen that cooperation.
And the poultry industry? I mean, we've already had fights about the large operations, the CAFO's large chicken operations.
And that's a subset. That's a tough one. Yeah, it's a specific issue, and there's a lot of environmental impacts from these CAFOs, and they need to be evaluated. And not only the environmental impacts, but also the zoning. I think they need to be located in areas that are not going to impact residential areas and not impact existing homes and neighborhoods, because for a number of reasons. Number one, there's a serious question about airborne problems with asthma, and just to have that next door really does devalue the residential neighborhoods for obvious reasons. But nevertheless, there's a zoning in particular. That's the function of zoning, to make these uses that are incompatible when they're next to each other, both available in areas where that incompatibility is either eliminated or minimized. And so again, it's a question of federal and state environmental regulation and review based on science, and then local zoning to manage those impacts in a way that best promotes the public good.
I want to turn to education. We know that the price of education is going up year after year, particularly the higher education. I can remember when I went to school, which many years ago, which maybe a couple hundred dollars, and I was good for a state college. No more. What would you do about the cost of education? Would you have free college? Some people have suggested that. Certainly Bernie Sanders suggested that. Hillary Clinton was a little more modest about the idea, and particularly student debt.
Another great question, because it's a serious problem. And I want to start with a little historical perspective. In 1971, the cost of attending UMES in Salisbury, $322 a year for tuition. So a student could move home, work 6 weeks at a minimum wage job, which was $1.75 an hour, and have enough money to pay tuition for a year. Students today no longer have that option. We need to invest in public education. My view is that we need to make up to 4 years of public education at college and right. universities free tuition. And the example I just gave shows that we have already done this.
The question is, how do you pay for it?
How do you pay for it? Okay. The military budget this year, they requested $554 billion, which I believe was about a $60 billion increase over last year. They ended up with $700 billion. They ended up with a lot more than they requested. If we took $80 billion, and invested it in our educational system, that we could have done that right there. So it's not a question of it's not a difficult choice, but it's a question of what is the political will? Are we ready? Are we willing? Do we want to invest in our young people, in our higher education? And it's not just higher education, it's also job skills and technical training. This administration's budget proposed a reduction of 40% in job training and job placement. Now, we do have a lot of available jobs, 6.6 million available jobs, which is a great number. The problem is we don't have the folks with the technical skills and the qualifications to fill those jobs. Employers are looking for highly skilled workers, and we don't have those workers. The short answer, by investing in our students, by investing in job training and technical training, we are building our economy. We're building families. Strong families make strong communities. Strong communities make a strong country. That's where we need to be investing, not throwing money at the military.
Let me turn to then trade. Seems like a logical conclusion here. We, of course, have the president pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership agreements. We see him talking about more bilateral agreements between individual countries. We also potential trade war, as it were, with China, with upping the tariffs. Where were you in terms of the TPP, and how do you view trade policy? And what do you think about the free trade deals in general?
So I was against the TPP for a number of reasons. Number one, I think that it would create a race to the bottom in terms of American workers' wages. We've seen the effect of NAFTA where in Easton, for example, Black & Decker plant used to run 24 hours a day, used to employ, I believe, 800 people on a shift. And all of that has gone. All of that has gone right over the border from Brownsville, Texas, into Mexico. They pay their workers $50 a week. And those jobs were good jobs. Those jobs, I knew lots of folks that worked at Black & Decker as a career. So I'm glad that we didn't get into the TPP. Now, the larger question, because of its effect on American workers' wages, the larger question is, how do we balance American interests versus, for example, the Chinese? It's a great question. And the Chinese economy and the American economy are inextricably bound, as we are with all nations. I believe that this idea of tariffs is the wrong idea. Tariffs do not work. Trade wars cause hardship on both sides. There's no real winning of a trade war. I think all economists agree on that. And I'm concerned about the policy that we see of America alone taking steps to distance itself from its trading partners and also its political allies. And this is just one more example of that. And I think that American foreign trade policy needs to recognize that we have mutual interests, that we can both benefit. All nations and countries benefit from more trade.
I guess one of the questions is, if free trade agreements are not the approach, if putting pressure on other countries through tariffs is not the proper approach, how do you get a country like China so that to agree to the idea that they're not going to take your jobs? I mean, what's the mechanism? What's the leverage?
So those decisions are actually made by individual companies, and they are made with profit in mind. And so Carrier, for example, shipping its jobs to Mexico, Black & Decker, same thing. The problem that we're having, and it's a difficult problem to solve, I don't think I have the answer and can't give it to you this morning, but here's the problem. Labor is becoming transferable. Capital is becoming transferable so that companies are investing in labor markets where the labor is cheapest. That hurts American workers. We need to develop an economy in America that is based on providing good jobs to American workers and American families so that they can enjoy a standard of living that we have enjoyed to this point. And it's a big problem. My sense is that clean energy is the number one opportunity, and it's a very, very fast-growing industry. It's providing fastest-growing number of new jobs. We need to be investing in clean energy. We need to be getting on board with climate change as real and adapting to it. We see, and virtually the entire world is in agreement that this is a national and international and worldwide threat to security, and it's a threat that we can deal with, but we have to start. We don't want to cede those economic opportunities to other countries like we're doing right now. We don't want, for example, the Chinese to become the preeminent innovator, manufacturer, and deliverer of technologies that will promote clean energy. And yet, I think that's what's happening.
I want to try and find it, minutes we have left. Foreign policy, particularly, we have the president, of course, who's pulled out of the Iran deal. I'm interested about what your reaction is to that and what your sense is about foreign policy overall in terms of how we relate to various regions.
Well, let's talk about the Iran deal first. I think it's wrong to have pulled out of the Iran deal for a number of reasons. Number one, again, the world opinion and the facts are that Iran was in compliance with that agreement. If America breaks its agreements, then the question becomes, how credible are we? How reliable are we? Credibility and reliability and predictability are essential. If America is going to be able to negotiate in good faith with foreign adversaries that have competing interests, we simply cannot renege and violate agreements that we have entered into after years of tough negotiation with our partners, with our European allies, with Russia and with China. This precedent is the wrong way to go. I'm very concerned about the precedent that it sets, because I think that our credibility, our reliability, our trustworthiness to follow through with agreements that we make is essential. And we have, in my mind, always honored our agreements. Once we start going in a different direction, we introduce an element of uncertainty that's a self-inflicted wound. And it's the significance of that wound remains to be seen.
By the way, what do you make of the summit that's coming up with the North Korean leader and the president?
Well, I think it's a great sign. I think that there have been previous summits between North Korea and the South. This is the first one between the U.S. and North Korea. I applaud that. I believe that it provides an opportunity. I am concerned with the level of preparation, we know that the president doesn't read his presidential daily briefs, and that concerns me because I'm not certain about the level of detail that he'll have going into that negotiation. And I'm also concerned about the level of what I'm going to label as overconfidence in his own ability to negotiate a deal. When you're dealing with real estate in Manhattan, something you've dealt with from the time that you first went into business, that's one thing. When you're dealing with international relations that deal with nuclear weapons that have worldwide consequences, life and death, survival or not, that's entirely something else. And there are experts in that field who understand how that works. And I'm not certain that the president is willing to rely on experts for guidance. So
we've been speaking with Mike Pullen. He is a Democratic candidate in the 1st Congressional District here in Maryland. He would, of course, probably attempt to unseat the incumbent Republican, Andy Harris, if he wins that primary. And we appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you, Don. Really appreciate it.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. You know, one of the things I love most about food is its power to bring people together. And that food is a gateway to understanding culture. So it's in that spirit that every week we bring you stories and conversations that look at the world food first. That's The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters from APM, American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 10 on WSCL 89.5 FM.
Want to learn the ABCs of Berlin? It's been called America's coolest small town. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. There is a new illustrated book by that name, which celebrates 150th anniversary of the famous town and photographs and illustrations, using, of course, the entire alphabet. Its author and illustrator is Joanne Guilfoy. as a university professor, she says she has taught the satisfaction of illustrating an idea with more than just words, and she's in our studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let me ask you, first of all, how did you decide to come up with this, or how did this project begin?
Actually, it went way back to a hardback book that I had written called Flying Over Delmarva. When I got it finished, my daughter, who's a doctor in the Navy, said, Mom, and I have two granddaughters, she said, you need to do an ABC book. And I went, So I did. And I was in the process of walking around in Berlin and trying to figure out how, you know, who would carry the hardback book, who would carry the ABC book, because the center of the hardback book is all about the banner planes and the Bunting family, and I thought, and they're a Berlin family, and I thought, well, this book should be in Berlin. So I stopped into Victorian Charm, got to talking to Steve and Debbie Freen, and Steve looked at me and said, well, what about Berlin? What about an ABC book for Berlin? And I went, I don't know anything about Berlin. So he handed me, literally handed me the book produced by Arcadia that the foundation, Historic Foundation, had partnered with, and that was a few months ago.
So, and half of it's in color, half black and white. What's the thinking behind that?
Having been an art educator and raised two kids, I remembered that you can read books to kids, but at some point they need something to do. And I decided to, rather than have colored illustrations, which appear in some ABC books, I would use real, actual color photographs of people and places. But then also on the other side of the page, with the same alphabet letter and another object, have a page for kids to color, kids and or young adults and or anybody else. And so if they are young folks, of course, they'll scribble as kids get older, and young adults and adults, you know, then there's more detail for them. So it's a combination of both. I wanted both.
Now, as I was reading, you said that you were a reluctant reader when you were very young, and but then you sort of picked up in seventh grade when art became a primary communication form. Well, tell me a little bit about that experience.
Be happy to. I was not just a reluctant reader. I was a non-reader for many reasons. And I know that I was not alone, and still I'm not alone. Kindergarten, I was very sick, had much illness. First grade, I had all the childhood diseases. Now, you have to remember, in the 50s, we did not have vaccinations. I got one childhood disease after the other, and a couple of times had more than one. And I can remember our doctor coming to the house with a black bag. They had me parked on the sofa. So I missed a lot of first grade. Oh, darn. Then, later in first grade, I broke my arm. Oh, man, my right arm. So that meant learning to write neatly was not happening. Another time, I remember being hit by a car. Missed some school again. Oh, well. And by third grade, we had SRA, which was colored strips in a box. You had to read and then do a comprehension. I never got out of the yellow. And if I remember right, purple and blue were in the end. By third grade, we were writing book reports. I wrote one. I don't know how I did it, but I figured it out. It was a book of Cheerful Cherub. It was a book of poetry. And I turned in the same book report till sixth grade, one a year. I didn't care. Nobody asked. I didn't tell. In the 50s, we had group work, so I always did the artwork. I could do that. By sixth grade, it was over. I had a man teacher, Mr. Giorgio, in New York. I turned my little book report in. Can I tell this?
Sure,
I turned my little book report in, sat down. He said, Joanne Kurz, get up here. Okay. He goes, you didn't read this book. I looked at him. I went, so? His ham hock arm went down on that desk. Everything flew up. He was ready for me. He handed me a book. He said, you take this home. You have your mother listen to you read it. And I went, oh, man. On the terrace. And then bring it back to me. Well, I did. It was torture. But that was the beginning. And I brought the book back. The book was Pippi Longstocking. I was just like her. Anyway, that was it. And by seventh grade, I'm reading. I did okay. There was a stint sometime in elementary school in New York. Both my mother and I got pneumonia badly, and we were both kind of quarantined in my parents' bedroom. And I remember somebody gave me Misty of Chincoteague, hardbound book. I can still see the cover, the ponies. I couldn't read it. And that, I think, and then they also gave me pastels. And so here we are with pneumonia, coughing, hacking, and I'm cluttering up the air with pastel dust. I was drawing away. But that was, I thought, man, I need to learn to read. I was in love with horses and eventually in high school had a thoroughbred. But anyway, I decided I needed to learn to read.
Now, were you always good at art, at drawing?
Or
was it just something always was always there?
Yeah, yes.
What is it like to sit down and draw something? What is that experience like?
Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's very hard. But the difference is, I guess, one of the things I've inherited is the motivation to keep trying. Painting, I do well, but it's also hard at times. Drawing, I guess I do well, but it's also very hard. But the difference is, I keep making myself do it. I think that's the part that got inherited, not so much the talent, but the will to do it, the desire to do it well.
So how do you come up with ideas?
Things on a rack card, I remember that my publisher was saying, look, you need a rack card, you need a business card, you need to do this. What am I going to say? And it just came to me. I love what I paint, and I love to paint. It's very difficult for me. I could never be a commercial artist. I could never support myself with my art, and thankfully I didn't have to do that. As an art teacher and then an art educator, I went to work, like all of you. My paintings, my drawings were what I did on my free time, and I will admit, this is May, the month of May. In my entire career, I looked forward to the month of May because my kids were in school, I was out, and I had a month to crank. I had a month to paint, to write, to get whatever I really wanted to get done until they were out of school the end of May.
And you talk about this idea about teaching the satisfaction of illustrating an idea with pictures. How do you communicate that with, and how do students respond to that?
I'll be quite honest. At the university level, when my elementary majors would come in and the art ed majors would come in, they were either scared to death or rather put out. And if they were scared to death, or, oh, God, an art class, an art teacher, I'm going, wait a minute. And so my whole impetus was art as communication, or even drawing as another way to communicate, mixing paint as a way, color as a way to communicate. And it seemed to work. And even now with adults, I teach painting in Berlin and Ocean City. And some of the, again, it's a mixed bag. I'll have so-called professionals and amateurs, but then I'll also have beginning students and sometimes homeschool kids. And it's the same. My attitude and my reason is the same. It's a way to communicate. It's a way to express yourself. Some of the larger paintings I did in the middle of my career, 4x4 foot, were autobiographical. You're looking at chickens, you're looking at racehorses, you're looking at dairy cows, but they were actually self-portraits. And it's not until you would ask me, really ask, what is this about, that the life stories would come out. So again, it's all about communication. That's all.
So then tell me a little bit about how you decided to organize this book and why the alphabet?
Two things. Again, it goes back to the ABC book that my daughter first said, Mom, you need to do an ABC book. And the idea was that, okay, if you have a substantial amount of text, data, information, surely there are objects that can be pulled out A to Z. Well, the hardest ones are always X and Z. And in the ABC book, X became X marks a spot, same thing in Berlin. And then you can use a map. Z was always about Z's, falling asleep. And there were guys, pilots in the flying over Delmarva who were asleep because they were very tired. And in Berlin, I turned it around and said something like, it's not boring. You're not going to be going to sleep. But again, the A to Z idea was also to help people struggling to read, whether they're young children or adults. One of the things I did in Kentucky was work with adults that were having trouble reading. And they need, comic books don't always get it for them. Dick and Jane young reader books don't always get it for them. But something like this would have.
So what did you do to prepare to do this book on Berlin? Even walk around? What was the preparation there?
actually, probably it goes back, you know, way further than that.
Sure.
In graduate school, and that is true for these others as well. In graduate school, we were trained in Oregon to do ethnographic research, and that meant being good at quick and dirty research, getting the content of what you need, but then also being able to talk to people, being able to be invited into their home, invited into their store, invited into their life, and have them tell you something that is substantial. Or to give you, in the case of flying over Delmarva, they gave me heirloom photographs. Same thing with Berlin. I was accessed to, thankfully, through Ivy, photos from town that I would not have been able to take because I'm not there all the time. Inside views into some of the merchant stores because I'm not there all the time. So again, the training goes way back, but on the street, you still have to be able to talk to people and be able to talk them into what you have in mind.
And how do people respond when you were talking to them in Berlin?
Very positive. In fact, I kept going back to Victorian Charm, talking to Steve and Debbie and giving him an update on where I was and meeting Ivy at the town center. And then again, later on, the mayor, it basically fell into place. And I had the text done. She approved it, Ivy Wells, that is. And then it was just a matter of gathering photos. Now, it was almost hard, but the black and white photos here, and you mentioned Isaiah Fassett, but there was also a black and white from Eschams. There were a couple of photos that came from the Historic Foundation there, and I worked with Susan Taylor, who actually helped with the Arcadia book, and she went back to her board, got me the images I needed, because you can't take pictures of these. I mean, you can't walk around town. These people aren't here. And what I wanted to do, and the reason for that, is I wanted it to be not only very current with things to do, but also a glimpse to the past. And I will admit, in all my years of coming to Ocean City to go surfing, I would go past Stephen Decatur High School. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know. I found out, though. And with my family being Navy, I thought, oh, my gosh, look at this. And, of course, we go to Stephen Decatur for car club meetings once a month. And I thought, I've learned something I didn't know.
Describe what you learned about him and that we're talking about him.
Naval hero extraordinaire, but more importantly, a hometown. I mean, grew up in Berlin, grew up in what we now call Berlin, and went to sea.
Now, you begin, I guess, the book with for the Atlantic Hotel. Tell me a little bit about what that was like. I mean, it's an intricate old hotel.
Oh, it's so neat. It's so neat. Now, I actually hadn't set foot in it until I started working on this book, but the folks there were so friendly, and I was able to take pictures, but also use the ones that Ivy gave me. And I understand now that, you know, the other day I was just looking at a menu that actually had chicken on it. And the menu was the kind of thing where you walk in and it's not a la carte, it's just what they're serving that day. And I learned that there was such a thing called the Drummer's Cafe, meaning as a salesman would come off the train, they were drumming up business. They needed a place to stay, and they needed food. So this place has been here for a very, very, very long time. But it's so elegant, and it's just lovely. I mean, you walk in, and it smells like just fine dining. I mean, white tablecloth, white napkins, and I've only eaten there once. I hope to come back. But I think it would also be a very fine place to stay, just, you know, right there in the middle of town.
And right nearby, of course, we have the Globe Theater. Tell me a little bit about your experience with that.
Again, I was there only briefly a couple times. I would take friends and family to eat. I was there for a remembrance of a young lady who passed away. I would have loved to have been there in the day when it actually was a theater. But I think it's so neat that it is still used and used well by folks in town for a variety of, you know, of reasons. And I also, when I was there, and I didn't make the connection until working on this book, there are a lot of paintings. There's a lot of local art there, which I liked. One of the painters is Patrick Henry. And working on this project, I got to meet him and also feature him.
What did you think, by the way, of Patrick? And actually, I've met him actually many years ago on some other story, talking about obviously painting and so on. Why did you decide to include him in this? Particularly, you have him on the back. You actually have one of his famous.
He was an art teacher, and he's from here. He's like my hero. He got to do everything I wanted to do. I've always wanted to live in this area and be an art teacher, and he got to do it. He taught at Stephen Decatur, and that was why I put, you know, the piece about him being an art teacher on the back. He had and still has a studio in town. He made a portrait of Reverend Tinsley, and I found, you know, the piece in the Welcome Center about him, but what a neat thing to do. And he's still painting. I went to go see him. I told him what I was working on. I think he must have thought I was crazy. It's okay. And he just happened to have a print. I bought it, took it home. I said, look, I really want you, you know, on this book. And I said, this is how I would like to do it. And I think he was honored. I've been to visit him a couple times, and we talk painting. You know, we don't talk this stuff. We talk what it's like to be a painter.
Right.
And it's hard. At times, it's very hard. But he has stuck with it. He you know, his idea is to show, you know, the intimate sort of traditional views of Delmarva, and I think he's done it very well, very well.
Yeah, you see, matter of fact, you have a quote from him at the end. He wrote something about talking about a sort of intimate nostalgic images, I guess.
Nostalgic images of the Eastern Shore, which, you know, most people have in their houses. I think I did that kind of thing years ago when I was in high school, and I'll be quite honest, I think I got bored. But I do so appreciate that people are still doing that and do it well and do it well. Plus, he's just a fine gentleman. I admire him a lot.
Now, you also talk about live music. There's a whole slew of festivals, bluegrass, amongst other things. How did you come up with the kind of illustration that you had? What attracted you to that concept?
Well, again, it was Steve Freen. He had offered to have me do a book signing for Flying Over Delmarva, put me out, and here he was right on around the corner, and his guys were playing music. And I thought, I haven't been in this kind of environment in decades, where people are playing music on the street, there's stuff going on, people are shopping, walking around, eating ice cream. I thought, this is really nice. Very special, very special. And then as it turns out, there are many other venues in town where music takes place day and night, and very open. And he was thrilled. When I was in there last week, he bought a bunch of these to give to the fellows and the gals in the band. Because he said they want to see themselves. Not that cool. So hopefully we'll do, you know, I'll be back again. But on first Fridays, they do the art stroll, so there's always time when people are around. And then as the weather gets better, they'll be out there quite often.
You also have talk about the horse-drawn carriage. It's really a very classic kind of image.
Yes. Yes. And in terms of putting the book together, you know, you asked me, how did you make decisions? Well, a lot of times it was what was an outstanding color photograph, what would attract somebody's attention, young or small, versus what could make, you know, a pretty good line drawing and still be interesting, you know, to work on. This one was hard because I really wanted to draw the workhorse and the carriage, but the photograph was just neat. I mean, you don't see that kind of thing very often anymore. And the nice thing is in town, there are still trees because it does get hot. And the animals can cool off. So I thought, all right, put the peaches and, you know, the hail facility over to the side. But again, really nice to see workhorse in town.
And as you also mentioned, talk about there's a sort of Victorian feel to the town, right?
Right. And I think they've worked hard to preserve, you know, that turn of the century kind of time. And that's what the Main Street programs are all about. My work in Kentucky was really all about architecture. And one of the projects, one of my interests was in helping the Main Street program in that state. And what that means is they get federal money, state money, to not just change the facades of buildings on Main Street, but really put money into an economic development into those venues as well. And again, I will be first to admit, I don't know a whole lot about Berlin. I would pass through, you know, on my way to Ocean City, I'll be quite honest. But from looking at photos, they have done a lot of work to create that atmosphere and keep it vibrant.
So you also talk about festivals in general, the downtown. How did you capture those?
Oh, I tried. Like I said,
A short time period, I know.
Yes, and not, you know, having not been from here and not being able to attend many, although I would plan, especially this year, to be around a little bit more. I know it's something, again, that Ivy and the town work on hard to bring people in, but they've already got their itinerary, and the list is like 12 inches long. I mean, there's something going on once or twice a month from January to December. It's not just summertime. It's year-round. And they're, you know, the attempt is to bring local people but also bring people in from out of town for a purpose, to have, you know, a special event, a parade, a race, sometimes just a street fair. And it's an excellent, you know, it's really a nice place for all those things to happen.
So, of course, speaking of events, we obviously have Oktoberfest, Burley Oak, who's got their craft beer operation there. What do you make of that?
Right. And along with the bees is the bathtub race, which I still think is a bit odd. But yes, between Burley Oak and the craft beers and, you know, all these other things, it's almost like there's something for everyone. But again, with all these that are going on, also great family fun. And I think they've tried very hard and been successful in bringing families in. And the reason I say that, it was in the wintertime. I was doing a book signing at the toy store, World of Toys. And it was so neat to have dads as well as moms come in with little ones. That impressed me. I thought that was really cool.
Now you mentioned about the bathtub races. So just describe, by the matter of fact, this illustration that you've got there. I think it is.
Right.
Because I was trying to figure, I was looking at it saying, well, gee, now what exactly is this?
What is that? Well, again, I was asking the same thing. And this was one of those times I was trying to figure out, which do I do in color? Which do I do as a drawing, you know, for people to color? And I just made the decision, the color photograph about the boutiques and busy shoppers had more people, and it was really clear they were shopping. So I thought, okay, leave that alone. Who wants to draw people? But these things, these bathtubs on bikes, it blew my mind. And then when I went to the Welcome Center and I actually got to see one, and then I got to see photos of others, I thought, oh, I get it. I still think it's a little weird. I don't know that I would do it, but they certainly have fun. And, it, you know, even just from the drawing, people come out. That was what makes Berlin. You know, I don't know anywhere else where this kind of thing takes place.
Was there something that surprised you as you sort of visited the town and got to familiar with all the things that are going on in its history? Is there anything that came or was impressed you?
The thing that came out over and over again, and it started for me at the Worcester County Arts Center Council, but with every vendor, and again, too, with Steve and Debbie Freen, everybody was so nice. And when I began working with Ivy to nail down the text, the thing I had learned or been told with the other ABC book was everything has to be an object. It can't be an adjective. It can't be a verb. It has to be an object. Object, okay. So we're working on K, and kids is fine. She crossed out what I had and put kindness. And I said, that's not an object. She said, do it. And then I realized she was right. You know, when you go into the different vendors, the different stores, and just in dealing with everyone in general, they're nice. And then here's this older lady. And I looked at this photo and I thought about it today. I hope to meet her. I think I saw her in another photograph with the bathtub bikes. I don't know what you call those things.
Yeah.
I've not met her, but I loved her hands and I loved that she was smiling. And she's a volunteer, you know, a volunteer. So that's it. It's a nice place. And I make an excuse to go there, get ice cream, visit the store, teach an art class, walk around for a while. And then when I think I better get back to work, I leave.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago that you also did another book, Flying Over Delmarva. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, my.
Just briefly, in
okay,
the few
very
minutes
briefly,
that we have left.
Right, very briefly. I came here 4 years ago and made fast friends with some of the pilots where I volunteer at the Georgetown Airport in the maintenance hangar. And got to thinking about, perhaps in the 60s, I've always wanted to know where the banner planes come from, where they go, because it's not Ocean City. Everybody thinks they fly out of Ocean City. No, they fly out of a family farm in Berlin. So I started talking to them, asking questions, writing things down, and looking for a publisher. Long story short, within 6 months I had one. And within 8 months it grew from a book about the Buntings and banner planes to, because they also have a spray operation, to other sprayers, what we used to call crop dusters. Now we call them aerial applicators. And found a publisher and within a year had a hardback book. But then I realized, I mean, this is real neat, what we call a coffee table book. But then my daughter said, Mom, what about an ABC book? And then when I got going on the drawings, a lot of people said, why don't you make a coloring book? So I did. So like one thing led to the other. And something to do, just something to do.
So you have anything else planned? Are you like this kind of thing? Or
yes.
What are you looking at?
The publisher for this Berlin book and I are currently finishing. We're meeting on it tomorrow, one on Bethany Beach, because the gal that manages the bookstore at Bethany, when I was rolling in with Flying Over Delmarva, she said, what about a Bethany ABC book? And I went, okay. Well, that one kind of got derailed to finish Berlin.
Right.
One on Ocean City is on its heels. Should have been out last summer, but kind of got sidetracked. And along with that, when I get those done, I've started we'll call it a coffee table book on chickens on Delmarva. And I'm working with the folks at DPI and Kevin Fleming. And I'm really excited. There is as much a passion of mine as anything.
So you how much time does it take to do one of these books?
Oh, it depends on how much you give it. The Flying Over Delmarva, right. The coffee table book was a year in the making, but I did nothing else. Cranked it. I don't know that I want to work that hard again. It was really hard. In the meantime, the coloring book and the ABC book were kind of a pleasure because I had already collected the photos, and I just got to make drawings. I just had to find somebody to help me put them together. Same thing with Berlin. It was a pleasure. And the Berlin book happened in a couple months because it had to. Because it had to. Because this is 2018. This is the year it needs to be. So we worked hard to get it done.
Deadlines do focus the mind.
Yeah, it's hard when you're 68 and wants to do something else.
Well, what can I say? We've been talking with Joanne Guilfoy. She is the author of Berlin, Maryland, ABCs, and it's an illustrated book with lots of interesting photographs as well as interesting drawings, ones you can actually fill in with a little color if you if you approve it. And I appreciate the fact that you stopped by this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.